From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's been pinching pennies for public health, and the consequences are clear.
We're seeing a failure to fund the public health, the ending of the Affordable Care Act, the waning down under the current administration, and it's leaving a lot of people with a lot of health issues and the inability to address them.
Schools scrambling to hire teachers.
This has become a year-round effort for school districts, and it's kept them going right up to the very last minute.
Reflecting on the trailblazing career of Aretha Franklin.
She had 112 charted singles on Billboard. She had 18 Grammy Awards.
Plus danger at Lake Michigan beaches.
We're expecting waves to maybe reach heights of up to around 10 feet or so on Lake Michigan.
Those stories and much more for you today on State. Side. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When it comes to investing in public health, Michigan ranks near the bottom of the list of states, and the results are evidence, as a new report from the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Its title, An Ounce of Prevention, What Public Health Means for Michigan. Now, yesterday, we looked at community health needs in the Upper Peninsula. Today, we look at statewide trends in public health spending and programming. Eric Lufer is president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Eric, I found it interesting. This report points out that public health is a function of government that's often misunderstood. How so?
A lot of times when you think of public health, you're, you know, clean onto that public part of it, and we all know what health is. So you start thinking about Medicaid or Medicare or the VA insurance that's available to our veterans. So you start thinking about, well, that's the public side of it. Well, really, public health is sort of the contrast to that. When you go to a doctor or when you, God forbid, something happens, you need to go to a hospital, you're receiving private health coverage. It's sort of a doctor to a patient. And public health is a service that's provided in many, many ways for the whole community, and we all benefit from it. Whether you want to pay into that or not, we can't keep you from benefiting from clean soil, clean air, clean water. Services that are provided in many, many ways are there for everyone to receive. So it really is a public good.
So your report spells out a myriad of public health crises facing the state, summed up with a very stark statement. Michigan is a tremendously unhealthy state. You write about water quality, lead in housing, air and soil quality, food quality, hepatitis A, opioids, social determinants of health. It's quite a list. Yet, despite all of this, you point to data showing Michigan ranks 43rd in per capita spending on public health in the nation. In fact, the report says Michigan's in a state of public health subsistence. Paint us a financial picture of the state's spending and its reliance on federal dollars.
That's the real issue. This has happened for many years, so we have gone through, starting in 2001 and for the next 10 years or so, a series of issues where our economy was doing poorly and the state was struggling to get through, and it was cutting, cutting, cutting. But even before that, we were not doing a very good job of funding public health. So through all those cuts, we've got to a point where the state is only spending enough to pull down the federal dollars, because every federal program requires the local and the state governments to have some skin in the game, what's called a match. We've only been doing enough to provide that match to pull down those federal dollars and nothing more. And now we've gotten to the point where we're dependent on the federal government. If it says you have to put up more match, then we have to come up with those dollars. If it says it's going to end a program, well, now we're scrambling to figure out how we're going to maintain that, because they're all vital programs.
I think Healthy Michigan is, you know, the expansion under the Affordable Care Act. We know that's tapering down and ending at some point.
Right, and that's mostly going to affect people's individuals' health.
Yeah.
But now they're all this underfunding of public health. We're going to be less and less able to get them the medical care they need to go on. You know, it all fits together. The pieces of the puzzle are fitting together, and we're seeing a failure to fund the public health, the ending of the Affordable Care Act, the waning down under the current administration, and it's leaving a lot of people with a lot of health issues and the inability to address them.
And as your report shows and logic shows, the inverse result of that spending approach is higher costs in medical care and health insurance policies. So how do we move forward? What does adequate funding and a more efficient structure look like?
Well, if we could get to the U.S. average, that would be monumental increases in attention and emphasis on this vital public good. But we also have to look at the mechanism for providing that. At the state level, we've moved so many of the public health services into different departments to try to create efficiency. But in doing that, we've lost sight of the grand picture of how all this fits together. So we need to find a way with the next administration to put greater emphasis on this and find ways, even if we don't put them back into a single department, find ways to recognize what is public health and put greater emphasis on this so that we can increase the health of our residents. And a dollar spent on public health will equate into greater savings. It's not a dollar-dollar relationship. It's more savings on private health if we can invest more in public health.
As we approach the November gubernatorial election, Eric Lufer, are you confident in each candidate's grasp of the public health problems facing the state? Or even more importantly, what would your message to them be and to the candidates running for the state legislature?
Yeah, well, there's going to be a lot of discussion of taxes and education and roads, of course, fix the roads. But we have another public service that has been neglected and needs a lot of attention. And no, I don't have confidence that any of our candidates from any party have really grasped the importance of this vital service and has created a platform to really dig into how do we bring this under control and how do we get it going, moving in the right direction. Governor Snyder, I think because of the Flint water crisis, has begun to recognize this and they've taken some actions. But the trick is going to be moving that into the next administration and growing on the success we've had in these final months of his administration. So, yeah, we need to create a campaign to draw awareness to why this is so important, how a dollar spent benefits a wide, wide population, and really build on successes that are out there that we can create better health for all Michigan residents.
Eric Lufer, president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Their new report is An Ounce of Prevention, What Public Health Means for Michigan. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's great talking to you again.
Summer's winding down, and even as parents and kids are out there buying back-to-school supplies, school districts in Michigan are out there trying to find enough teachers to staff classrooms. There was a big teacher hiring fair last week in Lansing, and the Michigan Department of Education tells us over 100 school districts and charters signed up. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick is with us now. And Sarah, you've been talking with districts about their staffing levels and needs. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I have been. And as reflected by the attendance at that hiring fair the Michigan Department of Education had last week, it seems like this is a pretty big problem statewide where a lot of districts are looking to hire teachers right up until really the very last minute here before the school year starts. It's affecting rural districts, urban districts, and everywhere in between. I talked to a couple in Dearborn Public Schools, which is a pretty big district. They have over 30 schools in that district. David Mustanen, who is the communications director for Dearborn Schools, told me that they've had to hire about 470 teachers just in the past 3 years, and it's become a sort of year-round effort for them to get enough teachers in the classrooms.
When you're adding 70, 80, 100 or more staff members every year, that really does keep the human resource department very, very busy.
Mustanen says, and again, this was reflected in a couple other districts that I talked to, as well as state officials, that this has become a year-round effort for school districts, and it's kept them going right up to the very last minute, and it does put a strain on these districts, even the ones, as Dearborn told me, that has managed to get almost or pretty well fully staffed up before the school year actually starts.
I'm sure it does, because I know I was actually checking Dearborn's website, and they're going to have some kids back in classrooms Monday. So what about the smaller, more rural district, contrasting that to the big district that Dearborn is?
Well, they're having similar problems. It's certainly not isolated to districts of any size. I talked to Wayne Rodell. He's the superintendent of Fowlerville Community Schools in Livingston County. And he told me that this was pretty much the toughest year he's ever experienced trying to get enough qualified teachers in the classrooms.
We hired 7 people in the last 2 weeks. All but 2 of those folks had experience, which means they're coming from another district.
Superintendent Rodell pointed out that while that may be a good thing to be finding these experienced teachers for the Fowlerville schools, it creates what he called a kind of ripple effect, which is at this point, it really appears the pipeline of new teachers, although obviously there are new ones coming into the system, that's not nearly as many as it was just a few years ago. So they're really looking at sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul, where if one district gains an experienced educator, that's another district's loss. And in many cases, it's the loss of the higher need districts that may not be able to pay as well as some of the better off ones.
Sarah, do we know how this is? Is it because the pipeline is drying up, fewer people are going into education, or is it teachers who get through, do a year or two, and decide, I don't want to do this anymore, and leave the field? What's set up this scenario?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. From what I'm hearing, we know that there are definitely fewer people going into teacher prep in colleges. So that pipeline, is it hasn't dried up, but it's certainly smaller than it used to be. It seems like when I talked to Dearborn schools, they were talking about that there's this sort of bubble where they're seeing retirements, a lot of retirements. So they have a lot of teachers now, I guess, on the more experienced end of things who may be nearing the end of their careers. And then they have teachers who are, you know, just coming into the system, new teachers. So there's this sort of bubble in the middle there where sort of those mid-career teachers seem to be sort of there seem to be a lack of them at this point. And then there's just this idea, you know, pretty much everyone that I talked to talked about this sort of devaluing of the teaching profession, whether that be in, you know, political rhetoric or whether that be in, you know, just the sort of stagnant pay that most public school teachers have faced over the past few years. So there's really a combination of things going on that leads to a sort of either stagnant or smaller pool of teachers that, as you know, one person I talked to said, it ends up being a sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul situation in terms of filling up classrooms.
As you talk to the Department of Education and these school administrators, are you getting the sense, is this scramble for teachers the new norm, or is this some kind of cycle we're in?
Well, it's really kind of too early to be sure about that. People are certainly hoping that it's more of a cyclical thing than the new normal. But I think people are, you know, on MDE's end, they're, you know, a lot of their effort now is really going into teacher preparation and retention. Whether those efforts will be successful have yet to be seen. But they really are focused on getting, you know, shoring up that pool of teachers and getting more and more qualified applicants into the pipeline to sort of make sure this isn't the new normal. But it unfortunately may be. We'll just have to wait and see on that end.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Up next, an all Aretha Franklin edition of Detroit Music. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When Aretha Franklin died last week, the world lost a voice that was truly unlike any other. Her funeral arrangements are now complete. There'll be a public viewing at the Charles Wright Museum of African American History on August 28th and 29th, and then at the New Bethel Baptist Church on August 30th. Then comes the private family funeral at Detroit's Greater Grace Temple, which will be August 31st. And since the woman named by Rolling Stone magazine as the greatest singer of all time never left her Detroit area home, it is truly fitting that this edition of Detroit Music is an all Aretha edition. Paul Young is back with us, founder and publisher of Detroit Music magazine. Paul, let's talk a little first about her life and her career. And we should probably begin by tackling something we have heard and read in the last few days since her death, and it is a mistake. Aretha was from Detroit, but she was not a Motown Records artist, was she?
That's right. That's actually a common misconception, but Aretha never recorded for Motown Records. Certainly her sound did become, you know, quintessentially Detroit. And there was some crossover, as we'll talk about later, but she was never part of the Motown roster.
She always had a voice that was not of this world. And even when she released her first record, which is a gospel record called Songs of Faith, she was only 14. Briefly track her secular recording career for us.
Yeah, you know, by the time she was 18, she began her kind of her, as you put it, your secular world career. And after a little stint with Columbia Records, she signed with Atlantic in 1966. She was about 24 years old at that time. And by the end of the 60s, you know, less than 5 years later, she was known as the Queen of Soul. And that's because she just had back-to-back hits of Respect, Chain of Fools, Think, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, Say a Little Prayer. You know, and in her later years, she had multiple kind of comebacks, resurgence that happened at different points. One of them, one of the memorable moments of her kind of coming back to the cultural zeitgeist was the 1980 film, The Blues Brothers, where she did a collaboration. And yeah, so, you know, she had a lot of ebbs and flows, but certainly came out with a huge bang and ever since has been known as one of the greatest vocalists ever.
And to that point, Paul Young, give us the tally. How many charted singles? How many Grammy Awards?
Yeah, she had 112 charted singles on Billboard. She had 18 Grammy Awards, and that includes the first 8 awards ever given to the best female R&B vocal performance went to Aretha. She was also the first female performer to ever be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
And then, of course, as we mentioned at the very top, Rolling Stone has declared her to be the greatest singer of all time. Well, you've given yourself a difficult challenge to showcase Aretha Franklin's magnificence in 4 selections, and you wanted to start with a more recent track and then work our way backwards. So what have you chosen for us to hear first?
Yeah, so the first track here is I Knew You Were Waiting For Me, which is actually a collaboration with the great George Michael from Wham. And I thought this was a really interesting track to start with because it's not what we think of as Detroiters, as, you know, the first song that we hear of Aretha Franklin's tribute after her passing. But I think it's certainly important, and it also highlights there were many collaborations of Aretha Franklin's career, and this was just one.
Yes, I do remember that being very popularly requested at WDTX Radio, where I was working, and we were playing that in 1987. Who are some of the other big collaborators she worked with?
Yeah, so she actually released an album years later called Jewels in the Crown, All-Star Duets with the Queen, which kind of covered a lot of these collaborations. But just to name a few, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger on Jumpin' Jack Flash, Frank Sinatra, Michael McDonald, Whitney Houston, Annie Lennox and David A. Stewart of the Eurythmics, John Legend, Mary J. Blige. She did unreleased tracks with Ray Charles. Of course, we talked about earlier the Blues Brother version of Think. James Brown, Elton John, Mariah Carey, list goes on and on.
Wow. And I'm hearing you list these names, really cutting across the years, the generations with her collaborators.
Absolutely. And with this one specifically, I Knew You Were Waiting For Me. This was a number one Billboard Hot 100, won the Grammy for Best R&B Performance by a Duo or Group. And this was George Michael's, his only 3rd single of his solo career. And this was post-Wham and pre-Faith. And this really put him on the map as a solo performer.
What's our next selection?
Next selection is Mary Don't Weep, which is a gospel favorite of Aretha. And this was released on her 1972 album, Amazing Grace. It's Aretha's 3rd gospel album. It is the highest selling live gospel album of all time. 2 million sold in the U.S. It's double platinum. It also features Amazing Grace and How I Got Over, Old Landmark, some of those classics. It also won the 1979 Grammy for Best Gospel Performance. Jesus said, Mary, oh, Mary, don't you weep. Mary, don't weep. Don't weep. Don't weep. Tell your sister not to mourn. Don't mourn. Don't mourn. This song really throws back to the fact that her father, C.L. Franklin, was the minister of Detroit's New Bethel Baptist Church, which was really the center of the civil rights movement in Detroit. The original location, as you mentioned earlier, was where she recorded her first album, Songs of Faith, and the church, the physical location of the church, was actually displaced by the construction of the Chrysler Freeway in 1960.
All right, moving on. We go to 1969.
Yeah, so this one I also thought was interesting. This is a cover, The Weight, which was done by The Band. But this is another, You know, another example of Aretha coming onto somebody else's work and just completely changing it, taking it to a next level. Just like her many collaborations, Aretha's known for a lot of her covers. Respect, we'll talk about later. She did Bridge Over Troubled Water, which is a Simon and Garfunkel classic. Love the One You're With by Stephen Stills. She did a couple Beatles songs, Eleanor Rigby, Let It Be, Doobie Brothers. She did Tracks of My Tears and gave Smokey Robinson a run for his money. And then also Say a Little Prayer is a Dionne Warwick original. And then at the 1998 Grammys, she even did a Pavarotti cover when Pavarotti became sick and the last minute she had to fill in. That's a famous cover of hers as well.
Indeed. In fact, last week we had the pleasure of talking to her opera coach, Mary Callahan Lynch, who prepared her for that moment singing Nessun Dorma. And now let's take a listen to The Wait from This Girl's in Love with You, Aretha Franklin, 1969.
I pulled into Nazareth. I was feeling about a half past dead. I just need some place where I can lay.
Yeah, that was great. That song was covered by others. That was a band song, right?
Yeah, it was. And yes, it was covered by many people. I'd have to say that's probably one of my favorite right there.
Yeah, well, she could take anyone's work and cover it and make it something completely her. And then you gave us a hint as to your last selection, Paul Young, and that is?
Yeah, it's got to be Respect. And I had a hard time. I struggled with which one I was going to pick, but I think it's just really timely. I think it's such an icon of a song, and it would just have been a huge misstep to not mention it. But 1967 off of I Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You, Respect. Of course, this was her Atlantic Records debut. It's produced by Jerry Wexler and Arif Mardin. This was an Otis Redding song, and the original version was on his third album, Otis Blue, in 1965. And it was really about a man being okay with being taken advantage of by his woman as long as she acknowledges him, that he's putting money on the table. Think kind of like Bill Withers, Until You Use Me Up. And what Aretha did is she just totally flipped it, and she made it more of a protest song of abuse and neglect. She's a confident woman, and she's demanding respect, and she's saying, you know, the abuse is not okay, and I'm not going to take it any longer. So I think it's interesting, Otis's original version, that first verse says, what you want, honey, you got it, and what you need, baby, you got it. And Franklin's is, what you want, baby, I got it, what you need, you know I got it. The spelling out of Respect, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, the Sock It To Me's, the Take Care, T-C-B, which stands for Taking Care of Business, My Proper's When I Get Home, that's all Aretha. She adds all of that. So she really brought something completely new to this. 1968, this won the Best Rhythm and Blues Recording Grammy and the Best Rhythm and Blues Solo Vocal Performance by a female.
Boy, that does sound good. Final question, how will Aretha, do you believe, be talked about and remembered in years to come?
I mean, certainly she's got to be the greatest, you know, one of the greatest vocalists of all time. But certainly, you know, I would think this day and age, female empowerment, black empowerment. And also, you know, Detroit couldn't be prouder to say that this is someone that came from, you know, the Midwest, came from a hardworking town, a Rust Belt town. And, you know, I just think that the Free Press had her on the front cover of their paper, Detroit News as well. But she was on the cover of the New York Times. She was on the cover of, you know, the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. You know, she is internationally acclaimed. So I would say there's a special place for Michiganders and Detroiters for Aretha Franklin, and always will be.
Paul Young, founder, publisher of Detroit Music Magazine. Paul, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. For many kids, summer camp is a rite of passage. The first time away from family for a week. New experiences, horseback riding, archery. But for kids with developmental disorders, summer camp isn't always an option. And that's where Camp Tall Tree comes in. This Fenton camp serves kids with autism and other developmental disabilities. Josh McDaniel is one of the camp directors there and also the unofficial storyteller.
So this is actually a story that I started telling back when I was a counselor. So I was a lot younger. And half of the story was kind of just so I could get everybody into the spirit. Like I wanted to get, I had a group of 11 to 12 year old boys, which is kind of a hard time where you're kind of just at that point where things are too cool. Like if you're there's maybe I'm too cool for this, but also like you're like, but I still really want to have fun. So you haven't really quite settled yet. So I came up with this story to tell at the end of the night, every night. And it was kind of a progressing story. So the kids would all just be like really into the next day. The Tale of the Lightning Boy. A long time ago, back before we called this camp home, there stood a school, old and large like a castle. All the kids lived at the school, only seeing their families on major holidays. It had been like this for many years, so many in fact that parts of the school were already falling into disrepair. Because it was so large, there were metal escape stairways in case of a fire. However, they were old, rickety, and rusted. Every kid was told never to play on them, lest they fall. But we all know how hard it is not to explore something when we're told not to, especially as a kid. The same was true for a group of friends. They'd grown close at the school, almost like a second family. They loved exploring the lush woods, the tranquil lake, and all the parts of the big castle school. One evening, they found themselves intrigued by the old metal escape stairs. It was the only place they hadn't explored yet. They talked and joked for a bit about it, but eventually curiosity got the better of them. One boy dared the others to climb out onto the stairs from the window. When no one would, the boy decided that he would go to prove that it could be done. Against the protest of his friends, the boy climbed out onto the stairway. In the distance, there was a faint rumbling. The boy stepped out onto the metal grating. The whole structure groaned under his weight, but it held. The other kids were buzzing with a mixture of excitement and fear. In the distance, there was a rumbling. The boy looked out over the trees, over the lake, and the roof of the school. He'd never felt so light in his life before. Back through the window, the kids were still buzzing. There was a rumbling. The boy felt raindrops splash over his forehead. The kid's buzzing turned to concerned pleas for the boy to come back in. There was a boom! Light filled the room, leaving everyone unable to see for a moment. When their senses returned, the kids frantically looked out the window to see to their friend. What they found was the metal stairway mangled and smoking on the ground below, detached from the building. They rushed downstairs, worried that their friend was hurt. When they searched, they couldn't find any trace of him, not even tattered clothes. It was a sad day and a sad rest of the year for the school, especially the friends. The following year, all of the fire escapes were replaced. The friends began to adjust to the new year without the boy. It wasn't easy. But they kept together and continued to explore the grounds in order to keep a sense of normalcy. One day, they found a great tall tree. Must have been even older than the school itself. They took to climbing it, and one of the friends managed to climb higher than the rest, finding their way out onto a large branch high above the ground. What they didn't know was that the branch was half rotted. Before anyone could hear the first cracks, a large split raced up from the base of the branch to where the kid was clinging. In less than a second, the kid and the branch were in the air. The moment seemed frozen in time. Everyone watched as their friend succumbed to gravity. Not again, they all thought. But before anyone could finish the thought, a flash overwhelmed their vision. When their sight returned, they found their friend sitting comfortably on the ground. No scratches, no broken bones, with the branch sitting right beside them. They were all confused, until they mentioned the flash. They'd all seen it, but the kid in the tree had felt something. After they felt the branch break, the familiar sensation of falling came next. Every kid knows it, whether from playing or from dreams. But then they'd felt like something or someone had caught them. The next thing they know, they were sitting on the ground. They all agreed. It had been a flash, like lightning. Just like when their friend had disappeared on the metal stairs the previous year. It must have been the boy. He had flashed in like lightning and protected his friends from a big mistake. The friends took this to heart, and from that day on, made sure to check carefully before exploring too far. As the years went by, stories of other school children being whisked to safety by a bright flash popped up from time to time. The stories continued even after the school became a camp. They were passed down from group of friends to group of friends, until I heard it from a counselor of mine. Now I share it with you, the tale of the Lightning Boy. Whenever you've had a close call, remember, sometimes things change as fast as lightning, so think well and hard before you act.
That was Josh McDaniel, camp director at Camp Tall Tree in Fenton. You can find this and other campfire stories by going to our website, michiganradio.org. Coming up, what happens when someone's relationship with food and their own body spirals out of control? That's in about 5 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you're planning a swim in Lake Michigan today or tomorrow, you might want to rethink those plans. Waves will be big and dangerous. Nathan Jerusal is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Grand Rapids. So, Nathan, how big? How dangerous?
So we are expecting waves to start increasing here this afternoon and peak tonight. We're expecting waves to maybe reach heights of up to around 10 feet or so on Lake Michigan. The highest waves will probably be found across the southern portion of Lake Michigan, and they'll slowly taper off through the day on Wednesday.
And what's causing these big waves?
So we have a system that's moving through the area, and on the backside of that system, we have some stronger winds that are going to be building up, up around maybe 30 to 35 miles per hour, and they'll be coming out of the north and bringing some cooler air down, especially compared to what we've seen over the past couple weeks. Well, that cool air coming in over the relatively warmer waters of Lake Michigan will help to build the waves up fairly good, as I mentioned, around 10 feet or so. So that's what the cause of that is.
Now, some folks might say, hey, this sounds like fun. So tell us, why is it so dangerous to swim in these waves?
In these situations, there's many different hazards that come in Lake Michigan. So obviously, just the waves themselves, you know, if you have a 10-foot wave there, that's very dangerous by itself. But then there's other different currents that can also cause problems for anybody in the waters. Another real danger that we try to also educate the public on is near piers. In this situation, on the north side of piers, because of the winds from the north, we have different currents that will kind of cut around those piers. We've had swimmers that are excellent swimmers, professional swimmers, that have tried to kind of show how dangerous it is that they can't even swim against those currents. Hmm. So if a professional swimmer or somebody that's very experienced at swimming can't do that, then somebody that's an amateur that doesn't swim very much is very much in danger. So that's another one. And again, that's in addition to just the height of the regular waves.
So bottom line, if you're planning a trip to that Lake Michigan beach, especially the southern part, enjoy it from the beach and perhaps stay out of the water until these waves chill out by tomorrow evening.
Yes, we highly recommend that people don't enter the water with those types of conditions.
Nathan Jerusal with the National Weather Service in Grand Rapids. Nathan, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Food is supposed to nourish us, both body and spirit. But when someone's relationship with food becomes damaged and distorted, that eating disorder can interfere with their quality of life, and if not treated, could be fatal. We continue with our ongoing series, Minding Michigan, exploring mental health and wellness issues. Today, we say hello to Dr. Jessica Van Hise, a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan and clinical director of the U of M Comprehensive Eating Disorders Program. Good to have you here, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
So I think most people, it's safe to say, have at least heard of anorexia. They've heard of bulimia. But to be very, very clear, would you explain the differences and then also talk about some of the other kinds of eating disorders that people might not be as familiar with?
Absolutely. And you're exactly right. I think when people think of eating disorders, often what comes to mind is anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa. So anorexia nervosa is when somebody essentially undereats and becomes too low of a weight for their body to be healthy. And along with that comes distorted body image, sort of an inability to perceive that their body doesn't look overweight or obese. They might sort of see themselves as fat, even though they're very malnourished. And also sort of weight and shape take on kind of a central role in their life, so that the things that might matter to all of us, friends, relationships, how we're doing in school or at our jobs, those things sort of become less important than the number on the scale or what they see when they look in the mirror. So it really becomes all-consuming.
And bulimia?
Bulimia, we see similar patterns in terms of weight and shape concerns. And we also see a repeated pattern of binge eating and purging. So that can be via self-induced vomiting, using laxatives, other behaviors such as excessive exercise. On average, people with bulimia are about normal weight or even a little above average weight, whereas in anorexia nervosa, we see that folks are underweight. So that really becomes one of the differentiating characteristics.
And what are some of the other disorders that perhaps might not have quite all the spotlight?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even though they don't have the spotlight, they're actually more common. So binge eating disorder is actually the most common eating disorder. So this is when someone engages in repeated episodes of binge eating. And binge eating includes both eating an unusual amount of food given the circumstances. So this isn't Thanksgiving Day when we all kind of indulge a little bit. This is sort of out of the norm, along with a sense of loss of control over eating. So somebody just feels like they can't stop or can't prevent the episode of binge eating from occurring. So it's when we're seeing repeated episodes of binge eating, as well as some similar symptoms that I mentioned for anorexia and bulimia nervosa in terms of a great deal of concern about one's body and a lot of shame and guilt about the binge eating episodes.
Is there also a laxative dependency that people could develop?
People can develop a laxative dependency when those are abused. So we get into cycles where people actually have trouble going to the bathroom without laxatives and need to sort of be weaned off, which gets us really stuck, as you can imagine.
So when you think of how common eating disorders are in this country, what do the numbers tell us?
Well, the numbers tell us that about 0.5 to 1% of women will have anorexia nervosa. So that's actually the most rare eating disorder. Although if we think about other mental illnesses that we often think about, that's kind of on par with, say, schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. So or when you think of a group of high school girls, a class of 400 girls, there's probably four that are going to have anorexia nervosa in that graduating class. Bulimia nervosa, we see numbers kind of in the range of 1 to 3% on average. Binge eating disorder, even more common, 3 to 5%. Sometimes higher, depending on the study you look at.
I know. I saw the National Eating Disorders Association had that number of about 30 million Americans are coping with some kind of eating disorder. And I guess as far as danger, it's worth noting eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric illness?
Yes, they do.
Why is that?
I think it's because of the combination of effects from eating disorders that we don't see for every other psychiatric illness, just in terms of both the physiological and the psychological consequences of eating disorders. So we know that people with eating disorders have higher rates of suicide than people without mental illness. And we see people die from the medical complications of their illnesses.
We baby boomers will remember singer Karen Carpenter.
Karen Carpenter. I hear that one a lot from people. That's what everybody sort of thinks of. But this is really real and still happening today, that people are dying of their eating disorders. So we can see all kinds of physiological effects. It really impacts the entire body. Everything from bradycardia, which means our heart rates are slowing down, and other cardiac complications. With repeated binge eating and purging, we can see things like esophageal tears or ruptures. You can imagine the types of difficult consequences that we see. You know, like you said at the beginning, food is supposed to be what nourishes us. And so without it, we can't be well.
Is there a risk profile?
There are certain risk factors that we know increase the likelihood that someone might develop an eating disorder. What we also know is that no single factor tells us who's going to develop an eating disorder. So just because somebody has one or two or even three or four risk factors doesn't necessarily mean they'll develop an eating disorder. And we also see people where it kind of surprises us. Maybe they didn't have so many risk factors that we noticed. But some of the things that we do know about include dieting, so that might sound obvious, but really all of the eating disorders, including binge eating disorder, involve some sort of dietary restriction. Mm-hmm. So we see patterns where people might say, I'm just going to try to lose 3 or 5 pounds, something that many of us may have said in our past. But for certain people, they can't stop at just 3 to 5 pounds, and it just keeps going. And we also know that even in the illnesses that involve binge eating, one of the greatest predictors of a binge eating episode is food restriction. So when are we all at most risk to binge eat? When we've been either telling ourselves that we can't have certain types of things or we've been under eating throughout the day.
There's a pretty common view that someone who's most likely to become caught up in an eating disorder is an adolescent girl, probably white. Is that fair? Because I think, you know, just thinking of that kind of feel out there. What do you want to say about that stereotype?
Yeah, I think only one piece of that is true, and that is the word adolescent. Mm-hmm. So we do know that eating disorders tend to have their onset in adolescence, particularly anorexia and bulimia nervosa. Binge eating disorder is a little bit more varied. It can more commonly onset in adulthood. So adolescence is the most common time period that we at least see the onset of eating disorders. The rest of it, I would just say, out the window with those assumptions. We know that eating disorders affect all races and ethnicities, all genders, people of all economic circumstances, just sort of across the board. And we see that when we're treating patients.
Another stereotype I'll let you bust. Is this a choice?
Absolutely not a choice. So I think so many people think that this is just a behavioral problem or just something that if somebody sort of sets their mind to it, so to speak, that they could just sort of
Give it up. Yes.
Stop right there. And that's just absolutely not what we see. Somebody might make a choice to try to go on a diet. Mm-hmm. Sure, that's a choice that many mm-hmm. people have made. But once the eating disorder sort of consumes somebody, it is no longer a choice. The eating disorder is in control of their thinking and their decisions. Just like somebody who's experiencing schizophrenia and might have an episode of psychosis is not making a choice to be psychotic, somebody who's experiencing an eating disorder is not making a choice to have the eating disorder.
So professional treatment is essential. And based on what you've explained about the possible ways that eating disorders can ravage the body, early detection and getting into treatment must be particularly important.
Mm-hmm. I would say the first thing if a parent or a friend is concerned is to get a child into their regular pediatrician or primary care physician, they can take a look at some of those physiological markers that we might be concerned about, as well as weight and sort of how somebody's doing on their growth trajectory. So again, when we're thinking about adolescence, one of the things when you go to your primary care or pediatrician every single year for your well visits is that they'll look at their growth and they'll look at their growth chart. And what we typically see is somebody who's developing normally without any other developmental problems will sort of track along their own trajectory. So somebody that's always sort of been in the 40th percentile for weight and height, we would probably expect them to continue on that track. Somebody that's always been in the 60th, we would probably expect that. So when we see marked variations from that, that's a red flag.
And other symptoms, warning signs that friends and family may notice.
Yeah. So one of the things we commonly see is adolescents sort of declining dinner with the family or making their own separate plate or just seeing portion sizes decline, saying that they already ate. So not eating because, oh, I already had food, but that becoming sort of a persistent pattern. When we're worried about binge eating or purging, sometimes people will find remnants of food that had been consumed and hidden. So finding wrappers in somebody's bedroom or vehicle, for example, and also patterns such as going to the bathroom frequently after eating, laxatives going missing, things like that.
So what are the important do's and don'ts for a concerned parent or a concerned roommate or friend in first bringing up their concerns to the person?
Yeah, so something that I sometimes talk with people about, contact me and say, I have a friend I'm worried about, what do I do? Sometimes if you enter a conversation with someone saying, I think you have an eating disorder, that sort of puts their defenses up. They feel like they need to defend themselves. Instead, I sometimes suggest just sharing the behaviors you've observed. So, gosh, I noticed that when we went out to dinner the other night, you didn't order. And I saw that happen last week, too. Are you doing okay? Is there something I can help you with?
So what if the person who has probably a very elaborate defense thing constructed says, I'm fine, I'm fine. How do you push beyond that initial shutdown?
Mm-hmm. And I'm fine is probably the response you're going to hear the first time. So eating disorders are also very secretive disorders. Folks don't tend to immediately ask for help. That's especially true for anorexia nervosa. So I'm fine is likely to be the response you might hear. I think just continuing to be persistent and express that you're willing to help. If you're a parent, my recommendation would be to, if you're really concerned, don't listen to I'm fine. Do what your gut as a parent is telling you. If you know that something is going on with your child, and get them to their pediatrician who will help you kind of evaluate the situation and get you into the proper treatment.
So what's the treatment? What are the steps to recovery?
Yeah.
And what's the long-range prospect as far as is really getting your arms around this problem?
So there are several different kind of structures for treatment out there, and there are several different treatment approaches out there. What I can say is that no matter what, it needs to involve a physician to monitor medical status. It needs to involve likely a psychologist or a licensed social worker or other therapist to kind of do the therapy piece. And oftentimes we also need to involve a dietitian to help us kind of learn new ways to manage food. The treatment approach that research has the most evidence for when we're talking about treatment of adolescent eating disorders is called family-based treatment. So that's an approach that really involves parents in adequately nourishing and managing eating disorder behaviors. So parents attend every single session and learn. They've always had a healthy child up until the eating disorder sort of hijacked their child's brain. And so just going back to those things that they already know how to do and help them feed their child in a way that's going to sort of promote recovery. And what we really see is for many individuals, once eating normalizes, the intensity of the worries about weight and shape decline just as a result of normalizing the eating patterns. And then we're in a better spot to manage whatever cognitions are still remaining and to sort of use a cognitive behavioral or other therapy approach to work through those.
Do you see many relapses?
We see some. Okay. The literature is mixed on how often it occurs. I think the image that many people have is sort of once somebody has an eating disorder, they're always going to have an eating disorder. And that's not what we see. We see many people achieve full and long-term recovery. Depending on the study you look at, you'll see rates of about 33 to 60% of people achieve full recovery after treatment. Again, depending on the treatment approach used, the diagnoses we're talking about, there are people that need to go through treatment a few times before they achieve long-term recovery.
There are people all over the state of Michigan listening mm-hmm. to us talk now, and it makes me wonder if someone, if this is pinging somebody's mind and it's somebody, it's themselves or someone they care about, what's the best way for someone to get fast help where you're not on a, yes, we can take you in the fall, we can take you early next year kind of appointment? How do you get fast help to begin to break the cycle of an eating disorder?
Mm-hmm. And I think this question is so tough because eating disorder specialists are tough to come by. It's such a specialty area. And that's why I suggest a primary care physician or a pediatrician as a quick first step. You can usually get into one of those offices relatively quickly to at least have them help you figure out how severe is this? What level of care do I need? There are different levels of care available. So outpatient treatment involves seeing a therapist and a dietitian and sort of visiting your medical provider, maybe on a weekly or every other week basis, whatever is indicated. There are higher levels of care. So here at the University of Michigan, we have a partial hospital program, which means individuals are with us 5 days a week for treatment, individuals and their families. And there are also residential treatment centers throughout the country. There is not a specialized residential program for eating disorders specifically in Michigan. So when that's indicated, we're talking about going out of state.
Well, we have put a link on our stateside page at michiganradio.org to the National Eating Disorders Association that I know, Dr. Van Hise, you feel is a good source of sound information to get people started researching and answering their questions.
Yes, it's a great resource. I would recommend it to anyone who wants to learn more or is looking for some help of where to start.
Dr. Jessica Van Hise, Clinical Director of the U of M Comprehensive Eating Disorders Program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.